Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. For this episode, I travel to Washington, D.C. for the 2017 AWP Conference and Book Fair. There, I interviewed writer, teacher, and model Chris Campagnoni, who edits Pank Magazine and is the author of Death of Art, published by CNR Press. I also interviewed CNR and Pank owner John Gosley. I interviewed them at CNR's AWP table within the busy convention center space for the conference and book fair, and Chris began by reading an excerpt from Death of Art.
This is the best part, the moment before it begins. Holding the door for you like a lover would. Everything has to start somewhere, and somewhere begins on my palm. Your shirt smells of you, and I hold it to my face, and through your smell I feel my lips, and now I exist. Sweet sugary water on my tongue, over my mouth and lips. Sweet syrupy river of blood and flesh, of breath and spit, and what there's not a name for. You turn the music on and draw the blinds and feel real good. Anything can happen, you think, except you know what will happen and you've planned it out that way. Open your eyes, then close them. Open your eyes and turn it up higher and hear the tremble on your walls. Hear the tremble coming through the windows and the door. You feel real good, and you think you could even bear the sight of yourself in the mirror. You could even look at yourself for hours on end, so long as there's music to be made and a mirror to be made and marched to. Death, death, death and life, death. Music and its notes, which carry their own death within themselves as they ebb toward conclusion, completion, another song, the track switching, one finger on a key. This happened so long ago, you think, as the voice rushes toward you, as the cymbals gyrate and the synth drum rolls, as the vibrato finds its way into your limbs and your limbic. This is still happening, again and again, every time you listen. Every time you hear the recording, recorded somewhere else, in a different room, so far and so close at the same time. Death, death, death and life, death. The air, the light, they shifted. I remember the first film I saw in HD. We just bought something bigger than my outstretched arms. We brought it home and we put it up in the sitting room and it sat like a black mirror. All the lights were off and the screen was lit like a rocket. Names rushed by and then a title, or a title and then the names. We sat in the sitting room and we stared. It was like looking into another world, and I wondered if the camera would pull back to show the other cameras, the people in the back, the director at his chair, if he was sitting, the kind of hat he might have worn on the day they filmed this, unless they were still filming this. These moving images existed all the way. Things had gone too far, never to return. I would have liked them to remain only images, flickering in the luminescence of a flat box. But they were sharp, sharper than my own hand when I looked at it, and I thought to myself, this must be wrong, this must be off. The smile on the package, the smile in the air-conditioned stillness of the sitting room, the smile, each smile close to my face like a dream, hands reaching toward the sky, catching me from behind and lifting me up like a wave, to be sitting across from my girlfriend at an overpriced restaurant in Brooklyn Heights, telling her this. Or I'm only thinking about this evening, which amounts to the same thing. Because as I think, so do you. That's how this works. That's all there is. I would so like to forget myself, let myself go, leave my mind. I would so like to turn it off, I tell her. Wouldn't that be nice, I ask, as a basket of bread arrives and a person in a black button-down disperses? Wouldn't that be nice? To let me leave myself from time to time, to not always be writing, to not always have the words in my mouth, and to not feel how they feel on my tongue, the texture and the taste. But then I tell her, I think that's stupid. That's the worst thing in the world, the worst thing I could ever wish for myself, and even as I say this, I write it down. And she agrees. She puts her hand on my hand on the table. She looks at me softly. She agrees, mouth half open like a dreaming child. It is I who have been dreaming all this time. Dreaming and thinking and writing all this time and speaking, saying something, half intelligible but intelligible enough to be met with affirmations, faint gestures, a nod of the head. Stop making sense, I think. Half of life is pretending. The other half is pretending.
Thank you, Chris. Tell me the story of how Death of Art found its way to CNR Press.
I was very fortunate to have been friends with John Gossi for quite a while. We first met because of his relationship at Fjords Review. He was the founder and the managing editor of that great publication. And pretty much a turning point in my career that I still often think about is when I began really owning my story as a male model who was working as a journalist at night and actually writing about that, to have no shame in the weird sort of binaries that I was trying to break, or unconsciously or otherwise. And one of the first pieces that I wrote that sort of spoke to that hodgepodge of identity was a prose poem called Billboards that was sort of, it resembled in form an actual billboard across the page. And he saw it, he loved it. We Skyped, we started a friendship, he published that poem, and I think ever since I wrote that poem and ever since it was published, not only did I feel empowered as a writer to write about my, in many ways, idiosyncratic experience as a person, but also I just got the confidence to write more, submit more, dive deeper into now what I would consider a completely hybrid, uncategorizable, a blurring of the genre in terms of nonfiction. So we met in that way. He published my poem, and then we stayed in touch. About a year to this date, he asked me if I had any interest in being the poetry editor at Pank Magazine. I texted him back probably something along the lines of, "Are you crazy?" There might have been an expletive thrown in there. And he said, "No, I'm not joking." So then we became co-workers as editors. And then he acquired, I think around the same time, CNR Press, which had a long-standing reputation for being what they stand for, which is conscious and responsible and looking at diverse voices, but also underrepresented voices. And he sort of was really familiar with my work up to that point, not only because he had published some of it years ago, but because we were actually first readers on much of our work. I mean, as you know, I think as a writer, one of the hardest things to get is that first reader, is even to have an audience prior to publication. And I think it's just amazing and so fortunate that I had him and certainly other people, but we relied on each other for early drafts of our work. So he was quite familiar with what I was working on, even in its nascent form. He knew I was writing a really weird sort of hybrid memoir that also encompassed the close reading of 90210. And he said, "You know, I don't even want you to look anywhere else. I trust you with this manuscript," and he really wanted to read it. And because of that enthusiasm and because of that excitement, I really didn't look elsewhere. I trusted him with the reins to it, and now it's sort of like a dream to be reading from it a year later.
The decision about your author photo, obviously it goes in hand with your work just in general as an art piece, obscuring your male model photos. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the decision to go with the obscured author photo piece.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was almost an easy decision. I was hoping that I'd have to convince him to do that. And he actually was really keen on the idea. And I don't know how to use Photoshop, by the way. So, like, it actually looks, I think, really cool the way it happened. I think I was experimenting. I uploaded a photo, and the one that we ended up using, and I just sort of, I think I used, like, the blemish tool. I didn't know what I was doing, and I just sort of, it comes up and it's like sort of like an eraser mark, and I just tried to like zigzag across my cheeks and my forehead and my lips. And I think what it did, it sort of superimposed. If you look closely, the lips are like where the eyes would be, and it's sort of kind of cool in a very like absurd way, which sort of fits the tone of the book or the loose plot line of me trying to remove my image from all the editorial photos that I've been in, which of course is impossible, right? Because that's part of the internet, it's uncanny visibility. So I thought it's sort of interesting. And one review actually that I read recently of the book mentioned the fact that, like, oh, if you're interested to see like what Chris Campagnoni looks like, you won't get the chance at the end of the book. And it mentions the author photo. And I thought that was interesting because of that visibility that I was sort of reacting against, I thought it was such an appropriate decision. And at the same time, a sort of moot decision, because I knew that even by removing myself from my author photo, people were inevitably either already knew what I look like or they would know pretty soon, right? Because, I mean, everyone Googles everyone else. So it's sort of also, I guess, in doing that, also acknowledging that it's sort of impossible, right? And I think part of this book is also interested in a decline of solitude, a decline of privacy, a decline of anonymity, and also thinking about anonymity as and its function as an empowering tool in an otherwise very public accessible culture. You know, like, how can we take back anonymity, or how can we think about being anonymous for its advantages? And how can we, how can we reclaim anonymity, among other things, in our culture?
And to that point, let's turn to the cover art. Very evocative, but it's a woman whose eyes are covered in a semi-anonymous format as well.
Yeah, I think they did a great job representing that also with the cover art, and I do think it blends with the two typefaces that are drastically juxtaposing in style, and I think it sort of also, I think, represents the marriage or the attempt to marry and reconcile high art and pop culture. You know, like I mentioned, I mean, there's so many intellectual and pedagogical, because I think I teach these things at Baruch and at Pace, so I kind of I'm able to test these ideas out. But so many like more intellectual, academic, cultural issues at stake in this book. And then, you know, you do get a lot about like the Care Bears and Beverly Hills 90210 and, you know, the Lost Boys. So there's so much at work here. And I think even in thinking about the decision to have death in a really different typeface and then of art in a really like, I guess, elegant typeface is representative of that. And I think even just thinking about her, right, she's covered, or it looks like a part of her is like an octopus, right? Like she has definitely tentacles coming out of her head. And I think that sort of just, I think, represents or is representative of just the hybrid form, how this is sort of, you can't really define it. I mean, we call it nonfiction, which is a beautiful thing, because it could be, you know, we could have called this a poetry book, or we could have called this, you know, a collection of stories, right, that are interrelated. But we were pretty conscious, and I'm glad that they were keen on this as well, to call it nonfiction, and really to, in doing so, reevaluate even the binary between truth and fiction and truth telling in terms of narrative.
Turning back to CNR Press and your role as a teacher, one of your fellow authors whose work you've taught is Andy Christine. Tell me about that decision.
Oh, man. I mean, it was an easy decision. I don't know if you've read her Little Big Book, which is Tall As You Are, Tall Between Them. But that excerpt that I read is, on a scale of absurdity, that's like a one compared to like what Annie can dig deep and give you and present to you in a totally new form. I feel like both in form, but especially in content, Annie's work is like unearthing, you know, a weird future that'll become totally normalized in like 15, 16, 17 years. I feel like she's not only a truth teller in how weird her fiction is, almost in an ironic way, but she's also, I think, forecasting or predicting. She's like a cultural prognosticator in the sort of weirdness that is also placeless in terms of time, but at the same time feels very relevant.
Chris, tell me about the excerpt you're going to be reading from Annie's book.
Yeah, so when we deal with her in my class, the students have a lot of favorite poems, but or whatever you want to call them, whether they're prose pieces, prose poetry. But the one that we keep going back to because of its uncanny resemblance to our current day and just keeps getting more relevant is a poem called God Wants You to Go to Jail, which I'm going to read for you today on page 12 and 13. And it's a prose poem. God wants you to go to jail. We are the children, and there was a God who wanted a target. He was man, and God loves you. God chose to send me to the hospital, and I can tell you this. He created us because the doctors have to know how to treat injuries in the combat zones of Iraq. And he was scared of us, Jesus Christ. I'm going to tell you, so listen to me. You go to State Street, East St. Louis, and in your head and mind, and you'll shake at night, and you go to the absolutely and say, please just let them shoot me in the foot and not the heart. And that was God who dropped semi-automatic weapons down your chimney. There was a God who told you to riot. He made the last hour with the strand of your hair. Listen, he made the white and black protesters yell at each other at the Central Park 5 trial, all holding signs written in the same ink and handwriting, all wearing earpieces connected to the same God. If that's the word of God, he will amount to me. If God told me you were going to start a race war, God saluted. And I backed to him, and that happened. So listen to me. I saw the God who told him to tell you to riot. And these kinds of black and white protesters always appear to us from the same van. So listen. The whites act and scream things that are sick and mean and racist, and the blacks act and say that those things are. And I saw both their hand signals for camera on. They keep his commands and come from him on TV. The news coverage was made to appeal to you, black young men, because you are strong, like me, and crowned in heaven, and that isn't allowed to happen on earth without God. Listen. When you know there were 2,000 black slaves on the Trail of Tears, you know that God wants you to commit a crime because he makes you go to school where you never heard that, but the crack dealer knows. I want you to pray for right now. I want you to listen to me and the crack dealer, who are anointed by God and the CIA. I want to tell you God is the savior waiting for you to pull the trigger into his heart and your mind, and savior, you'll go to jail. Jesus, thank you, and people, I'm going to tell you for the last time to knock a grandma in the head. Thank you that you're the Lord and Savior, in your mind, in the name of Jesus, and it will save your life. You're my friend, forever in prison in your life.
Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
And I think you could see the absurdity there, but also the strange relevance to our own culture, especially in terms of race riots and also the idea that everyone's getting the same news, and that it's also always represented to you. It's always manipulated to show you a certain thing, you know, a camera on, a camera ready. So I like a lot of the themes, and I think we share a lot of the thematic concerns, cultural concerns in our work, but I think you see with her really an insistence on, I would say, the paranoid sort of conspiracy narrative or tone that I think really comes out in a sometimes comedic way, but also strangely true. Like most good comedy, it's funny because it's true.
Tell me about some of your other fellow authors on CNR.
Yeah, I mean, I had the pleasure of reading with Christina Marie Darling when I first arrived at AWP 2 days ago for Rhino Reads, Rhino Magazine, based out of Chicago, or Evanston, actually. And I've just been such a huge fan of hers for so long. She also, when Death of Art first came out about 6 months ago, it was the only nonfiction book with CNR Press, so I felt like I had a lot on my shoulders, but now we have a few others, and one of which is Christina Marie Darling's sort of also hybrid essays. More and more, I think the press is looking at nonfiction manuscripts, and I think just besides Annie's book, the other books that I'm thinking about teaching are all sort of represented by really underrepresented communities, and that's why I think they're always a good fit for the class that I teach at Pace especially, which is American Voices, both in like the daring sort of experimental absurdity at times of the form, but also the content, and also like who's writing these works. So I think CNR, whether they've been hyper conscious of it or not, they've done a really great job of representing and bringing out work into a mainstream audience or toward a mainstream audience that would otherwise probably have been silenced.
On the topic of silenced authors, there's been recently a big shift in relations with Cuba. One of the topics that you have taught Cuban authors who stayed in Cuba.
Yeah.
What do you foresee as you look from the outside at a, one could say, a softening of relations between these two countries? Do you see the works of these Cubans who have stayed in Cuba possibly getting more exposure now?
I would say I was very optimistic of that. And one of the presses that put out an anthology that I taught in total when I began teaching American Voices was put out, I believe, by the University of Pittsburgh Press. They've done a great job, especially compiling new voices of Cuba, or and by proxy, because they're new voices of Cuba, voices that were not at all represented within the communist dictatorship as early as the 90s, but also as recent as, you know, 2015. And the book specifically was called Cuba and Splinters, which I recommend to anyone. But then the other thing to think about is when we think of the softening of relations with Cuba, even my father was happy. My father, who had refused to go back to Santiago de Cuba, where he's from, for his whole life since he left a year after the revolution, he was even excited when, you know, we raised the flag again at the embassy and sort of the channels for not only tourism, but the embargo was sort of lifted in parts. But that was, you know, that was almost a year ago, actually, now when we think about it. And I don't think too much has changed. And I think also we might, and I think might is an optimistic word, but we're probably going to be taking a step back with that softening of the relationship with President Trump. So I wonder if, you know, things will be quickly going backward in that direction in terms of softening of the relations. And I don't want to see that, especially because it would be especially cruel to have gotten that glimpse of perhaps a softening of relations and a creative sort of explosion and of course an economic one, to have a glimpse of that and then to have it sort of quickly reined back because of perhaps our new foreign policy would be especially tragic.
Finally, on the topic of Cuba, I believe when you were modeling, you would go under Chris Cuba.
This is actually a telling sign about the culture, especially when I started modeling in 2007, was that there were hardly any Latino, especially male models, but certainly there were no Cuban male models. And I think because of that one fact, I became known as Chris Cuba only because there were no other Cuban male models, or at least ones that were working regularly. Mm. So what other people think as a celebratory thing, I mean, it's not like I took it to be vulgar at all or a slight, but I think it was sort of, you know, a backward compliment because it was really the culture, meaning the fashion industry, that needed to diversify. Since 2007, there's been a lot more Latino representation in the fashion industry, both for women and men. So, I mean, I'm happy about that. But that was really one of the major issues I was tackling in my first novel, Going Down, which fortunately won the International Latino Book Awards, and actually which I think CNR Press plans to republish in a few years to bring it to a wider audience, because a small publisher in Hawaii originally published it. But I mean, I think that was representation just of the Latino male body in the fashion industry, not to mention the self-commodification and the objectification of that Latino male body, because especially the maleness of it. I remember sending out query letters, and I just was talking to a friend about this yesterday at a reading I was giving, and most people just read my name as Christina and figured that, and I was like, wait, what part of my query letter didn't you read? I was like, this is about male modeling. Like, this is the main character is a male model. And I just thought, you know, even in the positive responses I would get from their agents, they would call me Christina and say, like, to get back to them with more than a sample chapter. And I'm just like, why am I even going to continue this dialogue? And I think it's really telling because it shows that no one even thinks about, even still, to a male body narrative because of, I mean, obviously masculinity issues, but especially in the Latino community, I think. And it works both ways. So that it was just sort of interesting how much has changed and yet how much also has stayed the same. Mm.
Final question. We're here at AWP in Washington, D.C. You were here in a couple of contexts, obviously CNR Press,
yeah.
Also PENK. Larger question, what's the benefit in this day and age from your outlook of AWP for authors, publishers, etc.?
Yeah, and I'm glad you said this day and age. I mean, I think especially in this day and age, particularly in this day and age, when you're not getting enough FaceTime with people, and I mean real FaceTime, right? Not on your phone FaceTime. That human connection is so important. Even this, that human recognition, and I mean recognition in the dual sense, but certainly just recognizing someone in person that you've talked to and you've exchanged intimate communications, necessarily intimate, because they might be editors publishing your work that comes from your heart, right? That comes from inside of you, somewhere really deep. And you've maybe talked to them for years and you've never met them in person. I remember that's what really struck me the most at my first AWP last year, was I was sort of starstruck, right? I mean, because writers to me are my heroes. They're the people that sustain not only my community, but what it is I do for my passion, for my life. And to meet them in person, it's almost indescribable. It's this uncanny feeling to meet people like that, that you've communicated with and interacted with on such an important, deep level, and yet only through the internet. And so I think that's the obvious benefit. But I would also recommend for those either thinking about attending AWP next year or in the future, or just going to the, you know, if it's not their first one, just in general, I think the danger at some of these conferences are to treat them as a networking promotional event. I think that's the big turnoff to events like these. I think if you go in not only with an open mind, but with a real affinity for and an emphasis to really learn more about the people you're talking to really listen without thinking about what you're going to say, and to not prepare what you're going to say, and to think of it less as a job interview or something that you're talking with this person because you think that they can do something for you directly, then it's not going to be a good conference, no matter how much FaceTime you get there and that you give. I think it's all about learning about other people, and by proxy, maybe down the line, sort of like that anecdote to come full circle about John Gossi and just staying in touch with people. You know, good things will happen to you if you treat people with respect and with interest, but with real genuine interest that has more to do with what they're about and what their passion is and how you can help and how you can collaborate with them. And I think that even, you know, with our relationship with Nomadic Press, it's always been that way. And I know we talked about recently when we had that little dinner in Brooklyn, how everyone, it's more like a family. And once you start thinking about that, And I think that's why I also feel like CNR is such a family now, even 1 year later. It's made such a difference, and it makes me excited, and not at all even really for me and what work I'm coming out with, but rather everyone else on the roster and the editors and the interns, and it's a big family.
Let's wrap up with one last poem from Death of Art.
Sure. Yeah, so this is probably the most explicitly, at least in terms of title, a lot of the things that I'm concerned with the class I teach at Baruch College on internet and intimacy. And I had the opportunity to read it last night, so I feel good about it, let's say that. It's called Hands Free, Talk to Me. Hands free, talk to me, simply naked. Nothing but a bag of Stacy's Promise made with real baked pita bread. It's nice to know, and even better, to have instructions. Store in a cool, dark place. Close tightly after use. You fingered me as the one responsible for word hunger. Brief aside to my live streaming webcam, which is playing Do the Right Thing. Half-eaten poems on the floor, more than 5 minutes. Do I dare? I do. Save me for a rainy day. Every head clouds without question. Everything appears at home on television. Sadness fills me like an index and a thumb holding a rubber ball, sulfuric acid, some oil. We used to play every other week, more or less. Import files, splice our voices, kill the rest. Thanks, Christian.
You can read more about Chris's work at his website, chriscampagnoni.com. Now, my interview with CNR Press and Pank owner, John Gosley, who began by telling the story of his involvement with CNR Press.
So CNR Press was founded 12 years ago. I purchased the press along with my co-director, Andrew Sullivan, 2 years ago. And we have totally revamped and revitalized the catalog, added in a lot of diversity, and we're really thrilled about everything that we're doing. We're getting so much great work.
How does coming to AWP help CNR Press?
Being at any large event really raises your visibility. It also really lets you interact with the reading public and other authors, which we love to do.
And can you tell me about some of the titles that you're excited about that are on CNR Press right now?
So one of my favorite titles that we have right now in short stories on Tran's Meditations on the Mother Tongue. His family's originally from Vietnam, and he's an Asian American. And the stories that he talks about are just so moving and touching in terms of acclimating. And it's something that I think everybody can identify with, but coming through that lens, it feels very fresh.
That goes in line with something else I was going to ask you, which is, does CNR have a philosophical approach to the authors that they reach out to and want to publish?
CNR stands for Conscious and Responsible. So we get almost everything that we publish through our open submissions, and that's important to us. We want to keep the channel open for emerging and new authors. We look for work that is going to be entertaining, moving, engaging, funny, all the things that you want a great piece of literature to be.
One of your authors, obviously, is very familiar to me, Chris Campagnoni.
Chris and I became friends 4 years ago when I was only running the magazine Fjords Review, and we have remained friends ever since. I think that his work has grown immensely in that amount of time. And it's been really wonderful to be working with somebody and publishing somebody who is your contemporary.
And Death of Art is interesting. It's a mix of mediums, kind of. There's poetry, there is, I guess, short story in construction of how he uses words in a poetic or short story form. It seems like you guys, in working with him, gave him a lot of room to explore between the covers of Death of Art. How much input did you have on the construction of Death of Art as a final piece in terms of how to collate all of Chris's work into a coherent release?
Our authors always send us work that is pretty close to ready. Poetry is almost always ready. We go through, we make sure that, you know, the commas and periods and spaces and everything like that are in place. for novels, nonfiction, short story collections. We sometimes do some light editing, sometimes some heavier editing on one part of a book or another, but for the most part, everything is already there. And we understand the author's original vision. And when something can be a little bit better, we make suggestions on that.
Another interesting thing about Death of Art is the author's photo. What was your take on Chris Campagnoni's choice for an author photo?
Chris started blacking out his modeling pictures about 2.5-3 years ago when I started talking with him about the redactions that I was doing of contemporary poets' work. And we talked a lot about self-redaction as well. And I think that he took a lot of pleasure in removing this idea of himself from the work. I think that it's funny, and I think that it's interesting. I mean, what is a self is the question that I think when you're redacting your own photograph that brings up, and that's very much what Death of Art deals with.
So, of course, Chris is also a teacher, and he has taught the work of another CNR author, Annie Christain. Tell me about her and her work.
Annie Christain is one of my favorite poets writing now. The reason for that is because her work is so singular. Nobody writes about things the way that she does in her choice of subject matter, her mode of approach, and the way that she elegantly moves to conspiracy theories, religion, and a number of other, I think, you know, subculture topics.
When it comes to CNR's place in the book market landscape, what's the landscape like for CNR? What are you guys up against commercially these days?
So CNR is a for-profit, whereas all of the other presses that are here that are our size are all not-for-profit organizations. So we're not competing, I think, for a lot of the same spaces they are, because the work that we publish is not necessarily work that they would publish, but also our entire model is different.
Final question. You guys deal in tactile books. Seems like we're living in more and more of a digital society, even for reading. What's your take going forward on the viability of publishing paper books, specifically for CNR's place in that? How digital do you guys go?
Yeah, so I think that that is a very good question. All of our books are also available digitally within the first 6 months that they're out. That's an important place to be. But what we've noticed with our sales is really only fiction and short stories and some essays sell. Nobody wants to read poetry digitally, and the numbers show that.
Why do you suppose that is?
I think because in poetry, people are looking for an expression of intimacy, and I don't know how much intimacy you can get from a battery.
John Gosley, thank you for being on Talking Paper.
Thank you, Christian.
You can find out more about CNR Press at crpress.org. Talking Paper interviews like these are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now Season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us to keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Give as much as you'd like and get great perks in return. Talking Paper is sponsored by Nomadic Press, a literary nonprofit co-based in Oakland, California, and Brooklyn, New York. Find out more at nomadicpress.org. Nomadic Press and Pank Magazine collaborated on a live reading during AWP at Sixth Engine, a restaurant at 438 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. The event featured writers from Pank, introduced by Chris Campagnoni and Ashley M. Jones, and writers from Nomadic Press, introduced by Dallas Athent. The first was Nomadic writer Cassandra Dollett reading The Day Prince Left.
Started drizzly, the clouds were dark and held no purple. A warm buzz fading out, inky carpenter bees dying on the back porch. Dre Dog said, I knew you'd hit me. The infinites have come to take our starmen. Though the songs are still here, we'll miss his thongs, his heels, his squeals. We could text about 1,000 times we had sex to his music. The 2 times we saw him in concert. The babies that could have been ours. The line down Van Ness when the galaxy was a new theater and it was the summer of purple rain. You had pictures to the ceiling, from the floor. You reminded me of me in that room of desire, insides twisted up and longing. You were not like the others. We held anger close to the surface. Prince understood how we punched and made love after. His was Baby Making Music, the soundtrack to conception. I would have done things different if I knew then that I'd still know nothing now. How I held my boombox, filling the schoolyard with dirty mind, danced a sweat in my room, a kerosene lamp and delirious. The 1999 cassette rewound over and over my practice for San Francisco, where I danced like those new wave kids that Eddie Murphy made fun of. How Jessica played When Doves Cry while me and her brothers screamed suicidal tendencies. How even the songs others covered were purely his, and I felt that about you, like the wedding band meant nothing when you came throwing pennies at my window. She didn't know which songs were ours, I don't know either, or exactly what I was holding on to, spent more years hating you. But still remember your smile, how big your mouth was, screaming down that ride at Great America, up and up and then drop. You all uvula and me scrambling to hold on to my purse. Prince's naked ass on my Love Sexy t-shirt. Prince did change our funky molecules with freakiness and intent. He took us to church, altering our ideas of freedom, shaking the rivers of our bodies into delicate designs like snowflakes in a storm. He was everyone's hero. Roller skating, rainbow colored sparks, afro or perm, he made us nasty girls, even on the limousine floor. Apollonia pretty and proud.
Next, punk writer George Anderson reading part of his short story, The Kaleidoscope Kid.
He lay awake in bed and remembered being 7 or 8 at his friend's house. The epic occurrence of those times, oh glorious nth birthday. All the kids were over to sleep in bags on the floor, and he found out that night that he hated sleepovers. The dark in the strange room was not the same dark which he knew in his room at home. The two darknesses divided and hid whatever lay between them. Perhaps that was the first splitting. Dark from dark he separated them. Evening and evening, the first gloom. That was not the only fracture which he endured that night. As the evening dissolved into apocalypse, which was the requirement that he fall asleep in a sleeping bag in a strange darkness far from Mom, he found a truth too old for his age. He stood at the end of the long hall where two sliding mirror doors did not quite meet on broken rollers. There, in the center of the world he could never enter, two broken halves of himself did not align. Between them, the space or a plastic bar, or perhaps the closet's primordial night, it was a nothing, a hole where his unity was not. Thence, out of that awful vertical line of a void, thence came his splitting. He tried on suits at the men's warehouse, and he thought, "Excuse me, young man, but who are the beautiful young men in the mirrors? They're us, of course. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You would think time left one out of the magic number, but no, we're all here. Because you forgot to count the one in the center of the mirrors, the one from which it all comes. That's 6. We take that hem up, and these pants cut a real manly figure." The assistant took measurements. The men's warehouse didn't lie. The 6 of him already liked the way they looked. "Now the jacket, this combo really nails it, what with your build." "Oh yeah." He turned and flung a hand onto his hip. All his selves turned with him. "Don't worry about the black, they're the exact same black." "Right." The figures turned a few more times. If only they'd worn ties to complete their ensembles. "Okay, I'm really selling you on this combo, but you gotta try this jacket." The figures slipped out of the jackets and tossed them to the assistants. "You got a more understated lapel here, a little narrower, a little more casual, very much your generation, tailored close around the waist, which, again, I sell a ton of these to guys your age." The figures loved the slim tailoring. The jackets pinched in perfectly to the one fastened button, giving the figures waist like women. The loveliness was almost too much. The figures might fall in love with each other. "You like that?" "I love it." "I knew you would. I'm thinking chick magnet. Do the kids still say that?" "In my case, yeah." The assistant laughed. "You're a man's man." But they were anyone's men, and mostly, quite possibly, their own men. Their own magnets, attractors and attracted, fusion and sixfold refraction. "Now if you want, I can loan you a tie. I mean, let's really put this baby through its paces." "All right." A tie appeared, perhaps by invisible hand, emergent from the hung jackets. What an Excalibur for the mythic 6 Arthurs from a lady of the lake, oh so ready to romp under the coats. The ties looked all right, but this isn't really something I would wear. "Okay, let me see. What's your look? Bright? Patterned?" "No patterns. Bold and minimal. And thin. I don't wear fat ties." "Bold and minimal. Yeah. Another tie came out of the ambiguous lake of polyester and wool. This one, yes. The swords which the figures could really pull from the stones. Now that's fly. I can see you picking up some girl at 8 o'clock sharp, you know? Yeah, I like this one. With the pants and the jacket, I can give you the tie for, $24.95. I'll take it. My man, good choices. Now, you want us to take up the hem on those slacks? Oh, sure. And the jacket, let me get some measurements. The tape came out again, this seam, that seam, here to there. We take this in a little, which will nail the whole look. Sounds great. The figures slipped out of the jackets and stood, oh pillars of manhood, in the five mirrors. You need to pick a career, his dad said. It's that simple. Here you are, 24, and you have no prospects to speak of. I'm an artist, he said. I have infinite prospects. I'm talking about making money. Smack, smack, smack. They crunched their Crispix, each bite a little smackdown between them. I don't care about making money. Logan, I put you and your brother through school by working at the university. Without that tuition waiver, you'd be in debt for a music composition degree? That's nothing to go into debt over. I'm not in debt. I know that. I'm talking about your model as a whole. I don't have a model. How you view life. Okay, I see you and Mom, and I get that you built this life, like having a house and normal jobs and stuff, and I just don't want that, personally. Dad shook his head. Smack, smack, smack. They crunched on their Crispix. See, for you, Logan, smack, I think it's just a change in perspective. It doesn't have to happen overnight, but it does have to happen. You have to start thinking about the future. The future is all I think about. Then you need to start thinking about it realistically, so I can't succeed. Buddy, listen, I know you can succeed at any of those things. I'm just worried because all you do is paint and write and make music and whatever else, and to really nail it in any one of those, you have to devote your entire life to it. It's called focus. You won't get anywhere with half-assed attempts at each one. You have to pick one, and you have to go for it. The guys you admire in each discipline, they only got to that place by choosing and working. Working every single day on that one thing. But he was many. The figures couldn't decide which of themselves to eliminate. I love it all. Have you had any real world success with this stuff yet? I'm not trying to be harsh. I just want you to look at it in the cold light of day. I don't even see success that way, he muttered. Like I said, I'm not trying to make money. You're gonna live here the rest of your life? Me and Mom love having you, but we want more for you. I don't want it for myself. I'm sorry, I really don't. Don't you want an audience? Don't you want your stuff being seen or heard or read? I have an audience, he muttered. So he got a job. Somehow, with his work in desktop support as a student, with his stellar references, and doubtless having applied next to a stack of wacko carpet-bombed resumes, he got a job. In the whole process of Craigslisting and searching on Indeed and Monster and all the rest, the selfie called Ass Kisser, one of the six, had beaten all the other kids into a pulpy submission. He disliked violence within the body politic, and he had kissed Ass Kisser's ass, the only gesture which it understood. Now, having kissed many other asses in a maze of interviews, he was awarded the position of entry-level ass kisser. He moved data here and there. He made spreadsheets. He destroyed spreadsheets. He read and sent emails. His main job duty was to fill up the company hard drive. He began to take this duty more seriously, and he downloaded every meme and funny JPEG he found while surfing. Ass-kisser reprimanded him for this. He got to know Ian, another entry-level kid who sat at the workstation next to him. Ian was in a band just like Logan, but he also had goals. Rumors, unquiet tremors in the fabric of Ethernet cables, whispered that the supervisory role above them would soon go vacant. Ian saw that his time might come. Having always wanted success, obviously more than he wanted music, Ian was prepared to shift his life and give up his virginity to corporate.
Next, nomadic writer Natasha Dinnerstein, reading Love Me, I'm Fake, and Serial Eileen.
Love me, I'm fake. My hair is cotton candy, my skin resurfaced, I have been mani-pedied and buffed. My ensembles are designer, I have a revirginated vagina, and my nose is a job. I live in a faux storefront of Hollywood Main Street facade, absolutely nothing behind it. This is California, motherfuckers. Appearance is everything, and good lighting, the higher power. I'm going to read this poem about Eileen Wuornos, the serial killer. It's called Serial Eileen. Because you tied me face down on the red back seat of your Cadillac Seville in Volusia County and took away my power and made me float above myself and watch like some scuzzy bird, a pigeon. Because no fucker would give me a job, not even waiting tables, so I had to turn tricks on the highway, and because you had that 22 in the glove compartment waiting there just for me, I shot you. Because the rubbing alcohol, because you had that cheesy mustard polo shirt with the little guy on a horse with a golf club that said stuff to me about a world I would never understand, because everybody said, you don't belong here. Because Edgewater, Florida. Because you can stick your golf club up your ass. Because you said 100 in Brevard County, but you only gave me 50, and how am I supposed to pay the motel for me and my lady with 50? And there was 300 in your wallet. Thanks for that. Because in Daytona you smelt like Lister Mint, like my grandfather, and you had those ugly tombstone choppers, probably dentures. Because you didn't rape me in Suwanee County, but you were gonna, given half a chance. Because it was a defensive, preemptive strike, Your Honor, like the natural world, eat or be eaten.
Next, pank writer Ariel Francisco reading, "The young men along the bar are too tired even to die."
We wear our work below our eyes. How can someone so young be so tired? My mother asks on voicemail again. But I am too tired to call back, too tired to explain, too tired even to walk home and close my eyes. When's the last time the sun rose? I don't remember. The only light I know now is electric and hideous. The ring on the bar top from my glass is incomplete, broken like the moon in the sky that could be in any season if I could bring myself to look up.
Next, nomadic writer Holly Hardy reading, "The Animal Trail of Tears."
Look what I caught. A photo of a baby raccoon huddled in a cage popped up on my phone. It was from my mother. Oh dear, I thought. OMG, I texted. The next day I received another animal photo from my mother. This time it was a dead possum in a cage. Or maybe it was just pretending to be dead. Look what I caught, she texted. Jesus, Mom, what's going on? She didn't answer. She's lost her mind, I thought. What's she doing with wild animals in cages? Was she killing them with a shovel, like the snakes she found in her yard? Was she making pets of them, like she did with those wild chickens, the ones she built a pen for and then christened with Bible names? And then when they got attacked by a hawk and started cannibalizing each other at the sight of the blood, she was devastated. I imagined my mother trying to pet the possum, its unretracting teeth clamped onto her hand, the inevitable froth of rabies. She lived alone in the middle of nowhere in Michigan, surrounded by woods. She loved her little house full of giant jungle plants, the bird feeder outside her window, her ancient cat, Little Prince. She was a tough and tiny woman, a capable problem solver, but she could be a little crazy, and I worried about her. A couple of days later, another photo came through, a huge woodchuck pressed its furry face against the chicken wire of a 1x2 cage, eyes wild with fear and confusion. How did it even get in there? It reminded me of our childhood rabbit, the one Mom named Benjamin Bunny, even though he was a she. The rabbit wasn't very bright, and like a goldfish, she would eat and eat, which led Mom to believe that she was always hungry. Mom didn't like for an animal to be hungry. It seemed cruel to her. Soon the rabbit was so fat she couldn't turn around in her cage. And since we couldn't afford a new cage, one snowy winter Sunday, we drove Benjamin out into the forest to free her. Mom shook the obese animal out of the cage. She sat where she landed, perfectly still, black fur on white snow, pink nose twitching in the frigid air. She had never been in the wild and was probably too fat to run. I watched her from the rear window of our hatchback as we drove away. She still hadn't moved. Even at the age of 8, I knew she wouldn't last long before a fox ate her. More photos came through. A skunk, a couple of squirrels, a badger. I had to stop her. She picked up the phone on the third ring. Her voice was soft, deceptive. Mom, what's with the animals? I demanded. I've been trapping them, she said brightly. I'm a trapper. Yeah, Mom, but why? What are you doing with them? It's more humane this way, she said. I lure them into the cage with peanut butter snacks, and then I set them free. But why? Seriously, Mom, what you're doing is dangerous. Aren't you worried you're going to get bitten or scratched or sprayed or something? It's totally fine. I'm not hurting them. I'm just relocating them from my yard. I trap them, and I drive them a few miles down the road, and I free them. What is this, the animal trail of tears? You know wild animals are territorial, right? The squirrel, for example, stays in the same area its whole life and can live like 20 years. Think how traumatized it must be to suddenly move to another squirrel's territory. I just don't understand why you're forcibly relocating animals. I don't have a choice, she said. I can hear them at night. What if they get into my attic and chew on some wires and start a fire that burns down my house? I have to protect myself. It's not safe. Mom, there are ways to secure your house so that animals don't get in. No, she said. You don't understand. This is the only way. She hung up. After that, Mom stopped sending me photos of her conquests. A few years later, she moved into town, into a house with a yard. She planted a garden on top of a massive groundhog burrow, and then she began again the necessary process of animal relocation.
Next, punk writer Bethann Miller reading Your Bones.
I saw your skull in the Smithsonian today. Emmy warned me. She said I'd see you everywhere. Hear you on the radio, spot you in the cafe, smell you on the sheets I washed a dozen times since you left. She and Luke have been trying to take care of me, and I've been trying to let them. We've been exploring places I've never seen, tossing pennies and making wishes in the reflecting pool, climbing every step to the top of the National Monument. Up there above everything, I'm reminded how tiny every person can be, how they can disappear completely if you step away from it all. We wandered, almost dreaming, into the National Natural History Museum at opening. It smelled like a day that hadn't unfolded yet, cleaning products and the powder and milk scent of babies. There were lots of people, but I didn't see them. There was a lot to learn, but I didn't listen. We stayed for hours, aimless and without a guide. Did you know they found the giant squid and it's not as giant as you'd think? Did you know the Hope Diamond looks like the costume jewelry we found tangled under your mother's bed after the funeral? We threw it away with boxes and boxes of her lifetime. Do you remember? I turned to tell you these things, but you weren't there. I couldn't stop searching for you in every corner, down every hallway, as if you'd hopped a plane and decided you couldn't live without seeing this. Emmy pulled me along by the elbow, wishing she could stop me from holding on. She brought me to the ocean hall and pointed to a cartoonish picture of a naval ship sailing on endless waves of the sea. I was never afraid of the ocean till I saw this, she said. There was a blue whale drawn to scale, gigantic and overwhelming beneath the ship. Fear of the unknown, I nodded. Emmy shook her head, biting her lip and tracing the whale with her long piano fingers. I finally realized how monstrous the world can be. We visited the Written in Bone forensic files of the 17th century exhibit, which I imagined to be a cavernous grand room with bones that told stories. I imagined forensic historians had discovered how to read skeletons under high-powered microscopes. They learned that we've all got millions of tiny words written inside our skulls, our brains chiseling our deepest thoughts. Novels along clavicles, words around rib cages, written all the way down to the tiniest toe bones, revealing the deepest secrets of humanity. It wasn't like that, of course. There was a holographic cutout of a man in period clothing that transformed into a skeleton wearing a three-cornered hat as we walked past him. He was blissfully unaware that he was alive, then dead, alive, then dead, alive, then dead. The room was dim and crowded with families pressing their foreheads and palms to glass, breath from lungs crawling up cases. I recognized your skull right away. It was alone on dark velvet in the corner, almost forgotten. Broad cranial vault, flared nasal opening, heart-shaped, rounded eye orbits. These details, the tiny plaque read, are characteristic of individuals with Native American ancestry. You were so proud of your Cherokee descent, Native blood embedded back on both sides of your family. Somehow your parents found their way to each other, something inside them, an inexplicable sameness that never faded even after years and years. I tried to understand what that must feel like to be so connected to the intangible, to be a part of something outside myself. It's just a skull, Luke said when I pointed to it, a ring of fog circling my finger as I pressed it to glass. I imagined a world where your body was laid out in front of me without skin or blood or muscles or fingernails, without our tangerine and tobacco smell. Bones bare and bleached, the parts of you I could never quite see, the parts I could have loved more than anything. I would touch them, taste them, curl up inside them. Lay my body out on that same world, and people will see the ribs I cracked once. They'll see my fractured radius, childhood mistakes. But they'll see the quiet nights, too, when you and I rested our heads together and told stories by lamplight, the smooth parts of our skulls finding the perfect gentle slopes to fit into. They'll see our rhythms ebbing along our marrow. We didn't know it, but we were melding together then. We are alive now, hearts beating and blood flowing, and maybe no one will ever see our bones. Maybe we'll be buried in the earth or charred to a powder or sink deep into the ocean. In the museum, I rubbed the sides of my head just above my temples. I felt the smooth skull beneath my fingertips and searched for the divots we created together in our sleep. I'm afraid that we'll forget each other someday. Or maybe I'm afraid we never will. I looked down at your skull one last time. Luke and Emmy were waiting for me, waving me forward. In my last glance, I saw that the skull was a replica, polyurethane and plaster expertly formed over metal framing. A trick or an echo of the real thing. It was never yours. It was created under a stranger's hand in a place I've never seen, in a place we'll never be.
Next, nomadic writer Robert F. Santiago reading The Domestican and I Was Set Up to Fail, but Never Given the Chance to.
I watched a man put his hands through a woman, breaking each of his fingers. They fell to the ground like goldfish from a fat, clear baggie. I kept my head down, dragged it across the carpet as his knuckles burst open like the first buds in March. Rugged, pink, breathing. I made lines and dashes and clefts and valleys out of the loose red carpet fibers. I would like to say that if I was a woman's husband, I wouldn't do this, but I'm not so sure, and that is failure. And this one is titled, I Was Set Up to Fail, but Never Given the Chance to. It's a happy poem. I am so tired of being strong. I want to be a burden, a diatribe taken for granted, taken out of historical context, not at face value or account or political significance, but taken for long walks amid the winter frost. Snow-tired, black boot and crunched, an evergreen needle trampled in the gray and the slush. Or a sheriff in a small town that done bagged himself a jackalope for the den. All knotty pine, pelts, rifles, and horns. I want to be a burden. And those saying otherwise are liars, so fuck them. Fuck them right in their little faces, I say. Bearable crosses for everyone. Crowns of thorns as thorny as an army of florists can whittle wet. Strength is temporary. It's textbook. Big bang, overrated, bunk, librarian hushed and bruised, just a Freudian fantasy. It's a whole lot of noise, white noise, hung around the pink and prissy necks of elephants. Strength disregards privilege and pretends that shoulders to cry on never long to weaken, break down, fringe, disintegrate into lace, tulle, frill, and feelings. Strength is high jumping, has javelins for hands, and throws itself across fields and lands onto conclusions fetched much too far for even a poet. Strength is foolish, says foolish things with a straight face like, be a man, like, stop being a pussy, like, you want to cry, I'll give you something to cry about. I'm so tired of being strong because that is what men are. And if that is true, that strength is the sole measurement of a man, then the women in my life are some of the strongest men I know. It also meant I spent my entire childhood trying to be a good boy for no reason, since good boy and real man are not even remotely connected. Good boy is quiet. Real man is brash. Good boy is meticulously orchestrated, a symphony. Real man is the clanging of instruments in a box on a truck, rushing off to the next town.
Next, punk writer Annie Christine reading a fictionalized account of Kurt Cobain's overdose in Rome.
He developed the habit of playing errors, most correctly upon his chin. March 3rd, 1994, Rome. Using nothing but a Yellow Pages ad, I sold my parts to birth him. Don accompanies me to premieres of movies based on my mother's abusive second marriage. What the government arranged to make me malleable. In the movie, I take calls at my stepdad's trailer in an unincorporated area where I develop resultant moles and put that back, plays in low tones on the radio so I won't steal anything. Those melded stacks of forks and spoons and knives to give the trailer a lived-in look. The character can only speak using a Kabbalistic system language for several hours after visits too, just the same as me. The CIA entertainment liaison program is a real thing, whether it's been announced yet or not. At night, as the bellboy, I play all sorts of melodies on my chin to intimidate Don, and my chin has everything to do with it. We stare eye to eye, and the Doppler radar pulse wave either pulls a typhoon in or out, creating a stay of execution. But he was never supposed to be better than me in every way. I knit two woolen breasts and force him to watch. Wearing them, I balance vintage metal postage stamps on the bumps of his spine and explain it to him as it's been explained to me. Blonde boys make the best pets. When he tells the door-to-door Yellow Pages representative that the ad turned out to be a success, but success is subjective, I make a change come over him. That feeling of babies laughing in an empty house. Swatting a fly, of course he stops speaking in front of others. You know there's flies on you and there's flies on me, but there ain't no flies on Jesus. Proves to me what he's not. At midnight, as planned, the Yellow Pages man and I enter his room. When I flip a switch, red iron columns tumble above, pipes burst, my mouth fills with something like the juice left behind in a pot of boiled ribs. My point-blank headshot does no harm. Homo fuge, flea man, appears on his forehead and he climbs away on invisible steps. A monthly event from which I wake up in the woods. I learned somewhere that the heads of dead whales are reserved for the king, and the tailbones must go to the queen for her corsets. Imagine what they do to the whale if it lives. I'm starting to remember things.
Next, nomadic writer Elwin Michael Cotman reading an excerpt from his upcoming novella.
This is from a novella I'm writing about a young man who is a competitive breather at LSU. He hyperventilates. His twin sister ends up joining the team. She does digestion. This is how. That Friday, he met Jalen by the gym's front office. Her spherical afro emerged from a visor that was part of her head-to-toe LSU gear, a jacket, jogging pants, pennant, and purple Nikes, like she came for a match instead of a training. Getting to watch was a special privilege and might surprise her, so he told her what to expect on their way upstairs. She would see a room of warriors who didn't fear their own bodies, a waver sleeping on a blow-up mattress, EEG nodes suctioned to his scalp like white spider legs. The other waver would be monitoring his squiggly process on the screen, both of them wearing shirts that said brains with brawn. She would see the follicklers seated on a bench, massaging olive oil in each other's scalps to fertilize their luxurious hair. Because she might wonder why both were white men, Jeremiah explained to her that there was still an unspoken bias against black hair in biological sports, leading most teams to hedge their bets with straight-haired athletes. Coach Guidry wasn't going to risk his season in an effort to be politically correct. She would see a salivator laying face up on a weight bench doing throat crunches. A woman, since the team was co-ed. Modern science had yet to verify that men had any physical advantage when it came to things like swallowing and dream quality. Two litters would be practicing rapid blinking. Most shocking would be the two tractors squatting on short wooden boxes, tissue paper skirts covering their privates. Crunching their abs as their insides did the work of digesting a wheatgrass hemp flax cocktail. They could be disturbing to watch, adults in pseudo-diapers sitting on potties, their expressions of exquisite pain, and the room's anemic lighting giving the impression of a CIA torture chamber. And pacing in front of them would be Sam Guidry, yelling, "Keep crunching, Lachelet! Use your ab muscles!" He was short and solidly built, having kept in shape since his days as a respirator in the early 90s. He had a pocked face and broken veins on his nose, red as buckeye. Above that nose gleamed small, sardonic eyes. On first glance, a hard ass, but he invited students to his home for Thanksgiving, remembered birthdays, phoned parents to let them know their kids were doing well. A disciple of Mike Pepperdine, he used the legendary coach's breathing method. If you held your breath and listened closely, you could hear the hiccupy rhythm through his nose hairs, which were thick and blonde, like sheaves of wheat bundled in his nostrils. The Pepperdine method enabled Coach Guidry to distill his oxygen through the alveoli in such a way that the dioxide he exhaled was heavier than normal. Jeremiah told Jalen she might feel faint during his post-training monologue, a charming bit of time-wasting where he sat them down for a story, usually about how biosports saved his life in some way. But whatever you do, don't fall asleep. Coach Guidry would embarrass you. Jalen was unusually silent as she listened, keeping her bottom lip pinned under her incisors. Arriving on the third floor, Jeremiah was surprised to find the rec room doors open, exuding the sounds of voices raised in concern and fear. Instead of training, his teammates were standing around in various states of distress. The salivator was crying. A burly medic barked at the twins to move out the way as they lifted the half-naked form of Dave Lachelet onto a gurney. Jeremiah panicked at the blood smearing his mouth and chest. He groped for Jalen's hand and his fingers slid easily and functionally through hers, like two pieces of machinery locking together. He asked the dumbstruck litter what happened. "Gastrolis," he said, "the kind of digestive aids that alligators used." In front of the box, pebbles glinted evilly in a puddle of puke. Coach Guidry gave Jeremiah a passing glance as he followed the medics. It was his duty to accompany them to the hospital, but stopped in the door to aim a crooked finger in their directions. "Did any of you know?" he roared. "Did any of you tell him to do something that stupid?" No one spoke. Jeremiah could hear notes of Pepperdine in the air that hissed in and out of the coach. As a man's nostrils opened and closed like they were sending SOS, Jeremiah averted his gaze in shame, as if he'd been involved in this disappointment to Coach Guidry's honor. Gathering his thoughts, he told himself they were lucky it happened in training, and not the match, or when Lachelet was alone in his dorm. He looked at the floor so no one could see his face contorted with fear. His forehead felt hot, like a moth-frying light bulb turned on in his skull. Someone wailed that the season was over, and Jeremiah told him to shut up, although he was thinking it too. Down a man, they wouldn't qualify. He pictured his teammates' insides, their perfectly honed organs flowing dejected in the waterlogged murk. Then he noticed Jalen staring at the box and knew she was remembering her own sickness. Ruptured stomach and bacteria filling the cavity. Intravenous needle feeding her food and water. The weakness and loneliness. How, more than anything, she'd feared morphine and the oblivion it brought. She chose to diamond smuggle the pain in a suitcase of smiles, but he knew the memory of dying stayed lodged in her stapled-up guts. He asked his sister if she was okay. Startled, she blinked, as if waking from a dream. "But your team," she said.
Next, Pank writer Joy Diva Baglio reading an excerpt from her short story, Ron.
At this point, the narrator has been dating a guy named Ron, and she's been dating three guys named Ron, each one, and she's sort of noticing a strange pattern continue. And so it went on, my three Rons, each delicately and unsuspectingly stepping in and out of the other's way, unaware of their paralleled existences. Each relationship was casual enough that it allowed the others to exist, and yet all of them were inching slowly forward in the inevitable way relationships do. But it didn't stop there. Ron Wilkowski, who I met at a free wine tasting around the corner of the Orion, was a sous chef at Lizardo's, an adventurous eatery. That weekend, he brought me camel cricket custard, high in protein, which we sipped with red reishi mushroom wine. On our second date, he cooked for me from the wasteland of my fridge and produced, as if by magic, wildflower risotto, green beans almondine, and a rustic pear tart. "A real man knows how to cook," he said, a line that somehow seemed glaringly unoriginal. Still, I smiled back playfully. "Then you, sir, are a real man." A week later, I met Ron Hebert, a guide for Escape to Nature, an adventure company that led local expeditions into rugged areas. He whisked me away on weekend bouldering trips, his backpack stuffed with fire starters and space blankets. He scaled boulders with impressive dexterity and hoisted me on his shoulder during breaks like I was Dust Bunny Light. In our tent, on the pinnacle of some low-grade mountain, we talked late into the night, listening to the pulsing chorus of tree frogs and whippoorwills. The list went on. Ron Walden, a proctologist I met in the hallway of the ER, when I accompanied Ron Wessel there late one night with severe stomach pain. Ron Getty, a historian, who chatted with me over coffee. Ron Eggleston, a professional birdwatcher I bumped into while jogging in the park. Ron Greenwald, a trombonist in a marching band. Ron Svensson, a geologist. Ron Corey, jiu-jitsu instructor. Even my postman was a Ron, who was courting me slowly through conversations linked with package deliveries. I know what you're thinking. Why didn't I just stop saying yes? Weren't three or two or even one enough for me? How did I find the time? Why didn't I exempt myself from male attention, seal myself off in the land of taken or exclusive? But the fact was, my relationships were not exclusive. All remained casual. Too casual to commit, too casual to rule out any possible options. And half the time I didn't know a newcomer was a Ron until we were embroiled in the no-turning back zone, an hour into the most interesting conversation I'd had all day. He'd be telling me about the work he did on the human genome or the strange story you heard last night in the ER, and then he'd let it drop. By the way, I'm Ron. He'd slide it in there nonchalant, and what could I do? Thank God for the caller ID, or how could I have kept them all straight? Yet because I'd met most of them in proximity to my apartment, they started taking the liberty of dropping by unannounced. They'd simply buzz my bell and declare themselves through the small speaker system outside of my apartment. And since it was impossible to tell them apart in this situation, I came up with one of my own quirks. I like to use their last names. Sometimes an initial suffice, but the whole last name was better. I told them I got a kind of gooey fun from a last name, a naughty, scintillating turn-on. Made me feel playful in a tomboyish way. A last name gives me a real sense of you, I said. And they all seemed fine with it. Hey, it's Wasserman, or Greenwald here, they denounced, obliviously in compliance with my need to categorize them. When I was up to 12, or maybe it's less, I'm not sure if I added that. When I was up to 12 Rons, I realized this was serious. This was not how coincidence worked. Each wanted to see me on Friday or Saturday night, so I began a complicated system of rotation. I started allocating all my after-work hours to Ron dates, and the ones who saw me on Tuesday and Wednesday the week before got prime weekend time that week. Sometimes I felt like all the real joy in our dates had been crushed out, replaced by both a terror that they discover each other and by a giddy performance anxiety, a need to impress them all equally, to win them all more deeply. I toyed with the idea of cutting some from the continual addition process of our courtship, the not quite boyfriend status they each held in my life, but a need to get to the bottom of this consumed me. I needed each one to see what part of the puzzle he played, and my dating life took on a mystery detective flavor. I made lists of all their interests and highlighted repeated trends. I graphed their statistics, things like how much they earned, where they worked, body weight, age, the sports they played in high school, their favorite actors. I drew Venn diagrams, flowcharts, concept maps. I made lists of their morning habits, family histories, past relationships. Wachowski liked Russian classics. Lewis wanted to take me spelunking. Clark could order bubble tea in Mandarin. Getty played the bagpipes. Hebert wanted a treehouse. Bardacci sang opera in the shower. I tried to find clues in the name itself. All of them were simply Ron. Not Ronald or Ronaldo. Numerology assigned Ron the number 2, which was the most underestimated of all numbers. Anagrams and partial anagrams of the name included nor, no, on, which told me nothing. It appeared 3 times in the first thunder word in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake and seemed to portend something, however unknown that thing may be. I asked my friends what the name meant to them, what associations, feelings, thoughts came to mind. Sleazy, said my sister, in a 70s porn star kind of way. Greasy palms, drives a pickup truck. Quiet once, said one. Someone thoughtful, peaceful, an avid meditator. A serious name, said another. Someone serious about life, about you. But they were not serious, not one. I waited and waited, each extravagant, adventurous date after the next, under the luminescent halo of moon or the blinking of stars, in the cool summer grass, under the crackling explosions of fireworks, they remained unflappable, neutral, compartmentalized, happy to laugh and joke, to probe into the depths of the intellect or the mysteries of the universe, yet somehow distant from me. Each was content to wait a week or more until our next date, and the question remained, why were they all impossibly drawn to me?
Next, nomadic writer Matthew Siegel, reading a poem inspired by California's Bay Area.
This is a test, the voice says over the loudspeaker, on Tuesdays at noon in San Francisco, sending my eyes through the window to make sure it really is just a test. How badly I wanted to rid myself of my days, to get through them, thinking about plunging a ballpoint into my chest. I've been a vampire, a cartoon version of the sweet boy I must have been once. There are so many forgettings, but that's where life is. In memory, being remade when you think it's gone. Back in New York, Brian showed me home movies of when I was small and powerful as a stick of dynamite in my mother's purse. How strange to see her so thin and loving my father, who looks like me right now. I snapped pictures of the videos on the computer, and in my mother's tiny kitchen, she caught me by the arm as I swiped through them. Slow down, she said in a voice like that of a lover watching their beloved undress for the first time all over again. She asked me why I wept, and I lied, because it's so beautiful, when I really wanted to say, because it's no longer ours. I let her console me. For a moment, I stopped being a man. How many years since her hand last rubbed my back this way? When she's gone, this memory will be enough to crack every bone in my body. It has taken years to let her love me. Has taken the world crumbling to get me back to her like this. Bent, emptying myself of all I've been holding back. Oh, sweet and terrible and perfect, this pain, this love. Finally, I accept it. Invite it all in. From my window across the country, I watch the radio tower blink its lights, even in the daytime, and the voice of some strange god above tells us not to be frightened. This is only a test. It repeats, and the tower blinks through the day, through the fog, through it all.
Next, punk writer Sydney Tycho, reading Here Be Monsters.
Here be monsters. Now you get a little fist disorder, a little rough and tumble fingertip. You wet the heavy tongue. You rock the sleeping babe, that sweet lip, that Sorrento lemon. Peel, not pith, chilled deep, drink large. When some one thing other dies, you have issues with tense. You live or lived sickle bent, bending left. It hits that sweet part between the ribs because all your peace talk got you nowhere and now here and breathing. No one ever mistook you for parental. Lone or loon, here comes the end of the world, obviously. So when some oblivion comes familiar, you're screaming apocalypse all over everyone. Like real loud, you little shit. Tuck, bent, your long maw, your low lilt, hove or hollow. Shut that devout marked mouth, will you? Or dumb walk away, darkling, that globe of oranges is whirling around your head again. Forgive them if they stare at you like woe. It's just that your exercise of curiosity sounds like this. You open the ground with your whole funny body and like some air trembling a dish rack. And that dear catastrophe, when the marching band tumbled like dominoes, brass in hand, it's permissible to eat the peach, okay? It's okay to rock wild with guilt or not. Maybe you want a god you can swallow. Maybe the world is merely full of legs and so many places where one thing becomes another. And so what if you're the saddest motherfucker on the late train? You worry over your gums, soft palate, all this talk of mouths. What will you do now with your hands?
Next, nomadic writer Raina J. Leon, reading Poet Anxiety Disorder.
I know he loves me when I panic. We are trying to leave an outcast concert, and so is everyone else. Throngs from five different stages, bottle rock, bottleneck, one exit for thousands. I see a baby while I count, like I have practiced. First Spanish, Portuguese, French, I always get stuck in the 80s. Then remember up and down, 0 to 100, back. How many men? How many cell phones? How many beer bottles? How many light bulbs? How many black people? I don't go too far up. I ask him to teach me Italian. Count 0 to 200, up, down, twice. I make jokes. It's a defense mechanism to keep breathing, not feel, jab, throb, encroachment. I come from a place where every elbow means fight. White people do not consider the war of space, too used to having so much, not having to fight for so little. I sometimes deal in generalities. I am naming it. I am panicking because we are not free, no escape, no exit. I can't see a way. I flap my arms like a blackbird. I want out, I just want out, a way out. Just let me out, out, out. Almost hit another woman. Hold my arms close, rock hold, tears burn and track. He holds his arms out, protects my space, begins to rage at the white woman volunteer who calls into a useless walkie-talkie. We have a medical emergency. She wants me to go back to the stands, to breathe and capture, display a body alone, dark sky standing on a barren field. I'm okay. We are almost there. I just need to see a way. I know he loves me when I panic. In an email at the university, all lives matter. In an email, I asked my 7 black grandchildren and they told me I'm right, post-racial. In an email, when you criticize an administrator by name, it's scary. Whose discourse is preserved in plaintive civility? I can't be racist. I have a black friend, a black grandchild, and then, but some have called me racist. I count the emails. In English, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, get stuck in numbers like when I was the black invisible child stuck counting tiles in a diner while adults chatted after church. Or later, the checks in a man's tie when he said, "You're not as beautiful as you think you are." And later still, when I drive to work, I feel the panic rise again, surrounded by trees. Count the trees, not in.
Finally, Pank writer Will Cordero reading Dialogue with the Moon.
I swallowed the moon. My father, you see, always told me to do something useful. He called me a never-do-well, a ragamuffin, a poet maudit, a lazy rastabout, a dream rummager, a leaky rucksack for spurious ideas, a Swedenborgian devil, a doodle-brain sock-dolager, a gormandizer at culture's lard can, and 100 other things besides. Catching me napping or scribbling in my journal really expanded his vocabulary, you might say. My father was, since he's retired now, a lawyer. A partner in a big firm that defended important corporate clients, blue chips on the stock exchange. Whatever he did, nitpicking at terms, schmoozing, schmaltzing, holding forth, what was it worth? A lot of bluster, if you ask me, that only let the rich, tight-fisted bastards lord it over all the little guys, as if those fat honchos needed to add another pinstripe to their suits. Now my father sits around in his slippers, sipping scotch, puffing cigars, polishing his knife collection or trimming his cuticles. So yeah, one evening, out walking after my nap, the moon's big, ugly mug was staring me down, all beady-eyed. I asked, "Hey pal, what'd you ever do for anyone, huh?" And the moon looked back at me, square in the kisser, and he said, "I give light to the world." And that kind of set me back a bit. But then I said, yeah. Your light probably helps a thief in the night. But the moon went on beaming, smug in his high perch up there, doing his thing, giving light to the world. If a borrowed light, nonetheless.
Stinky cheesehead, I said, but to no effect. So I opened my mouth wide, a lost, dark, boiling sea down there. I opened my mouth, and I swallowed him whole.
You can find out more about Pank Magazine at pankmagazine.com, and more about Nomadic Press at nomadicpress.org. To listen to past episodes of Talking Paper, check out our podcasts at audioboom.com/channel/talking paper. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.